Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through, I guess, the different, you know, I guess we did sources 1 through 60 in this book, and we're going to cover Kadesh through Motzi Matzah. So from Mara and on, we're going to have no clue what to do for the Seder, but from Kadesh to Motzi Matzah, we're going to try to hopefully, we're going to, and the goal, I find halacha is interesting because we sort of know why we do what we do, and it's important to sometimes know some of the issues that are involved. So in the beginning, and if you know, so there's first a debate between the Rambam and Rashi, which is, why do we have four cups of wine? You notice that there's like this major debate as to why we have four cups of wine, which is, is it that you drink wine because wine is a sign of freedom, and we drink just a lot of wine. Why specifically four cups? So Rashi says because of the four terms of redemption, v'otzeisi, v'itzalti, v'galti, v'lakachti. So it's just you drink wine as a sign of freedom. And how many? So we have different possibilities of why the number four.
Like practical versus symbolic.
Is it practical versus symbolic?
The Rambam is saying that it's like to break up the Seder, right?
Right, well, I would say it's more than break up the Seder. The Rambam will say that it's to correspond to every time there's a different major mitzvah of the Seder, we drink wine to add chashivus, to add importance to that mitzvah. So what are the mitzvahs? There's the mitzvah of Kiddush. So when we recite Kiddush, we know Kiddush does not mean drink wine. Kiddush means we sanctify the day. So we add chashivus, we add importance to this mitzvah of Kiddush through a cup of wine. When we recite Magid, we start to tell the story. That's a very significant mitzvah. And we add religious significance through drinking wine. When we recite Birkat HaMazon. So some people do it a lot when they bench on a regular basis. Some people just do it on Shabbos. We drink a cup of wine. And then Hallel. So that when we perform the mitzvah of Hallel, we add religious significance through wine. So it's based on four different mitzvahs. You can look at it really as four different mitzvahs. Or is it one big mitzvah of freedom, and they picked four. There is Rabbi Nachum Kasher. He lived, I don't know, about 50, 60 years ago, I believe, maybe a little more than that. And he, I remember he said that the reason why we have four cups is just to create a difference between the night of Pesach and other nights, and other days, other religious meals, or other meals on your normal, let's say, holiday meal, you would have three cups of wine. I would have personally none, but on your regular, in those days, in the days of the Mishnah, in the Roman times, when they would sit down to eat, so they would have their one cup of wine for Kiddush. They'd drink wine during the meal. That was their beverage of choice. And they would drink wine when they recited Kiddush. So we actually have one additional to show that it's different. There's actually a lie, I believe the Magid Mishnah, right, somewhere, that they talk about different mitzvos that are what's called based on Pirsumei Nisa, to publicize the miracle. So we tend to think that the idea of publicizing a miracle is that everyone should see. So the classic examples of Pirsumei Nisa are Mikra Megillah, reading the Megillah, Ner Chanukah, and the four cups of wine. It's a little strange that the four cups of wine should be Pirsumei Nisa, because you could fulfill the four cups of wine simply by having your own personal Seder. It's a little lonely. But Megillah, so that's public. Ner Chanukah, people see it, that's public. The notion of the four cups of wine, how is that Pirsumei Nisa? How do you publicize the miracle? So I remember Rabbi Katterfogel was in Yagiz of Oshis, I think, 14 years ago. And I remember he made the point that the idea of Pirsumei Nisa means you're doing something different than you otherwise would to remember the miracle. So you know, you're reading a story, the story of the Megillah, that's unusual. You're lighting a candle, you light an extra candle inside. Normally only lit one candle when it was dark, so they could functionally. They're lighting, doing one thing that's different. So now we're having, instead of, this is sort of Rabbi Nachum Kasher's take on this, that instead of having three cups of wine, which is normally one for Kiddush, one during the meal, and one for benching, we're going to have an additional cup. So that's with Rashi's approach, which is, it's one big mitzvah of freedom, and we do something a little bit different. on Pesach, either because of the four Lishonos of Geula, four terms of redemption, and there are other things. The Talmud Yerushalmi has other suggestions of where we find four other times, but that's with the approach. It's one big mitzvah, as opposed to the Rambam, we're saying it's four different mitzvahs. I believe that's how the Brisker Rav understands the distinction between these approaches. And there's a lot more to talk about that, but we'll leave that for now. So then we move on to, you know, how much to drink. This is, I guess, sources 5 to 8 or 9. So there was this debate about, you know, Raviz, Lo Lugmav, right? So generally speaking, the idea of on Kiddush, you need a cup of wine that's a Raviz. And I guess we have to define what a Raviz is. We'll define that in a minute. The question is, how big does the kos have to be? How big does the cup have to be? What was it? One fourth of a log. Right, there you go. You take a big log, right? So that's a log. It's a measurement, we'll get into the fine points in a couple minutes. But it's the cup has to be a raviz, and you have to drink a majority of that, which is melo lugmav, which is a cheekful. Okay, now. So the question that I think hopefully you read is that there is a discussion and there's a debate as to whether you need rov revis or rov kos, right? Okay. In other words, normally, why would there be a difference on Pesach? Right? Because normally speaking, this was, I think. Where was this? I think it's in the Mishnah Berurah in source 10 in Taf Ayin Bay Sif Katan Lamed Gimel. So he says, normally speaking, you only require a rov revius. Normally speaking, when it comes time for Kiddush, all you need to do is the cup on which, remember, what's Kiddush? Why you have on wine? Because you're adding chashivus, you're adding importance. But you're adding importance to sanctifying the day through a cup of wine. That's what you're doing. The goal is, the wine is not so much the drinking. It's a means, right? It's a means. What's the end? The end is try to add, you know, importance to what you're about to do. So all you need to do is to taste it. So by tasting it, all you need to do is a rov, a majority of a revis of a log, right?
Which is 3/8 of
okay,
a meal.
Okay.
Okay. Very helpful.
Okay. So we'll get there. So however, on the night of Pesach, if the goal is actually maybe not simply to add chashivus, but actually to drink it and to feel the sense of freedom, to feel the happiness that you have, a little lightheadedness a little bit when you're drinking, so then it's not simply that a rov revius would be sufficient, but you might need a rov kos. And that's why, you know, when you get the cups for the Seder night, so if you get, that's a big question, like who gets, let's say you have a lot of people at your Seder, so who gets the 5 ounce or the 4 ounce cup, and who gets the 8 ounce cup? So whoever gets the 8 ounce cup, so do they have to drink a majority of that cup? The most middle position would be that that's what you try to do. You try to actually, he actually suggests you try to drink the entire cup, but that's the debate about drinking a majority of the cup or majority of a revis. Is it like Kiddush? It all requires a taste. Or maybe this is different because since you're drinking it to remember, you know, to feel the sense of freedom, so therefore you require a rov kos. And that's what the Mishnah Berurah said, that ideally you should drink a rov kos. We also discussed, I think there's also some sources about in the Mishnah Berurah, I think he's discussing in source 11, Taf Ayin Beis Sif Katan Lamed Daled, that you should drink it right away. That, you know, that there's like you have to drink it Kadesh Shasias Revius, which is two gulps. In other words, do we view the time in which you have to drink in the same amount of time that you would know that it comes when it comes to eating? In other words, you know, when people, they try to eat the matzah in a short period of time. By the way, it's not just a halacha when it comes to Pesach. It's a halacha when, let's say, on Shabbos day, when you have your piece of challah, you should have whatever that half slice of challah, you should have that also, b'chdei achilas pras, that time period of 4 minutes as well. So the people, yeah, so people, it's a general, in other words, the definition, if you think about it like this, that what's considered eating? Eating is, in halachic terms, you eat a certain amount within a certain period of time. You can imagine that if you would have a crumb, you'd have a crumb now, and then another crumb an hour later, another crumb an hour later, another crumb an hour later, it's not considered eating. Similar to on Yom Kippur, when people have to eat, if there are health issues, so we say have a little bit every 9 minutes. So the 9 minutes is the... Is that right? So in other words, like in Judaism, there's a debate as to what's considered, what this term, Kedei Achilas Pras. It can go anywhere between 4 minutes and 9 minutes. It might even go between 2 minutes and 9 minutes. But let's say between 4 minutes and 9 minutes. So Yom Kippur, where we tell people that if you need to eat, so we tell them try to eat. If you have to eat the small amount, because out there could be potentially dangerous, so try to eat something every 9 minutes, which is the longest potential shear of Kedei Achilas Pras. It's generally understood as probably more like 4 minutes. So when we say eat the matzah, or even on challah Shabbos day, eat that half slice or whatever, your slice of bread within the Kedei Achilas Pras, that's around 4 minutes. Generally speaking, when it comes to, let's say, to matzah, you know, some people try to, they pack everything in because they're very nervous, because that's not right. The reason why it's not right, because if you think about it, the notion of eating it in a certain period of time, so that assumes that you're eating it normally. So what they're doing is they're saying that the shear of a kezias, they're being machmir, they're being strict on the size of a kezias that eat a lot, and they're saying the shear of kedei achilas pras, which is whatever, 6 to 8 eggs. So they're taking a minimal shear. So they say we're eating a lot with it. That doesn't make any sense, because nobody, you're not required to eat like in an inappropriate way. If you eat normally, if you eat whatever your amount of matzah that you eat, if you eat it in a normal fashion, and you eat it in a normal fashion, and then that's clearly fine. Because if you did it continuously, you don't have to stuff it down. That's not
harder to swallow because it's so dry.
Right. So you can use seltzer is good, but that's not a halachic advice.
But that has to do with the bracha and the time between the bracha and the eating as well.
No, so that's my point. My point is you have to eat a kezias b'chdei achilas pras within whatever the kedei achilas pras, whatever it is. But the kedei achilas pras, that's like a 6 to 8 eggs. People sometimes take, let's say the smallest shear of a pras, then you would have to say that what you're eating also, that it also be a smaller shear. So you can't just have that, what you're eating is a larger shear, that's a smaller shear. The point is, if you eat it normally, then you're fine. But for our purposes, the question is, is wine any different? In other words, is the same rule of kedei achilas pras, is that only for eating, or is it also for drinking? And drinking is it might be quicker. And that's why the Mishnah Berurah says ideally you should drink it kedei shtias revius, like you would drink it, like the way you normally drink something, that's much quicker than, 4 minutes. That's why, by the way, you probably should never recite a bracha achrona in drinking tea. Because you would never drink tea in a quick enough time, because it's hot. You would never drink it tea. That's the general psak is like that. You would never drink tea in a quick enough time that would necessitate a bracha achrona.
Oh, so
you're
saying
interesting.
Well, the cake you make a bracha, it's fine. I'm saying the tea itself. That's
nice. Like if I'm just sitting and having a glass of wine, like with dinner, and right. I'm going to take my time with that wine. I'm not going to gulp it in 4 minutes.
Right. So that's a debate. In other words, we view it as if you're having, that's a question. That is, when they're talking about the time of drinking wine, are they saying that by itself or the context of a meal? I wonder if that's, I have to look into that. It's an interesting point. Like, is there a difference? Is there a difference if you're eating it, in the context of a meal? I guess for our purposes here, you're drinking the wine by itself, so that it should be by those gulps.
Right.
But you're right. It's an interesting point
you're raising. I feel like ordinarily, if you're having a glass of wine, you're not going to, like, chug it. You're gonna.
But you're not saying a bracha on it either. If it's part of the meal.
No, no, but.
No, I'm saying if it's.
If
not,
it's not, let's say it's not. Let's say it's not. Let's say you're just drinking. Right, you have a glass of water. Right.
You're gonna take your time with it. Like if it's a good glass of wine, you know. We're not
right. So I don't know what was done. No. So I don't know. So it's interesting. No, but Rachel, what's interesting is that in the time. Remember the times of Chazal.
Yeah.
They were drinking it, and that was like orange juice, right?
Yeah.
That was like orange juice. I don't know how they fucked it, but so that's a little different. But
right.
I wonder if it'd be different. So this notion of what a ravias is, without going to we're not going to go into all the detail, but it's based on two different questions. Like what are the sources here? This is sort of the source number is it number 12 or number 11? Source 12. Source 12, I think, is the Be'er Halacha and Siman Reish Ayin Aleph, where the Mishnah Berurah tells you that you should be strict on Shiurim when it comes to Doraisa Torah obligations, and you should be lenient when it comes to rabbinic obligations. There are basically two sets of stringencies when it comes to the size, the amount, what's an olive size, what's the size of an egg, what's the size of a ravias of a log. It's really based on a question of. Is the size? It's really quite well. Let's put it this way: when it comes to this, it is a question of right. The Noda Behuda, basically saw that the Gemara says that the size of a ravias is 2 thumbs by 2.7 thumbs. I don't know who's 7/10 of a thumb used, but he says the size of a ravias is 2 thumbs by 2.7 thumbs. And the size of a ravis, it's measured in thumbs, and the Gemara also says it's measured in eggs. Okay? So it's an egg and a half. So what he found is that they don't match. In other words, 1.5 eggs doesn't match to the 2 by 2 by 2.7 thumbs. Of course, you could
probably
debate.
Depends whose thumbs.
No, you're right. No. And, no, you should know, Rachel. Someone suggested that he went like this, as opposed to pressing them together, which makes a very significant difference. But in any case, so when he came out, it came out with two different shiurim, it came with two different measurements, and the Noda Behuda basically, then he came up with the idea that maybe the eggs of back then were much larger than they are now, and that's why many of these shiurim are doubled, and that's why if you heard of the idea of the Chazon Ish, the shiur of the Chazon Ish is much larger than, let's say, the shiur of Chaim Na, and it comes in many different contexts. That's why you have, is it 3 fluid ounces or 5 fluid ounces? So you have this debate. I'm just giving you little nuggets here because that is a shear unto itself, but it's based on the Noda Behuda, seeing that a ravis, it measured in eggs and measured in thumb widths, were different amounts. And how do you reconcile those two? How do you reconcile that? So because there's a more strict amount and there's a less strict amount, so therefore, the more strict amount, let's say, is 5 fluid ounces. There's a variation on these amounts. But let's say, for purpose of this, that the Chazon Ish says it's 5 fluid ounces, that's the more strict shear, and the less strict shear is 3 fluid ounces. So Bishop Bruce says, on the orizes, on Torah obligations, you should do 5 fluid ounces, and on rabbinic, you should do 3 fluid ounces. Now, it's not 100% clear, because the Mishnah Berurah takes a position that Rabbi Willig has a different view on. What the Mishnah Berurah says actually is that, and I'm sure some of your kids or grandkids, whatever, will come home and they may say this, that they'll say that what there's a difference between this year, between the first cup, Friday night, and the rest of the cups. Why? Because the rest of the cups, that is only a drabana. This is the rabbinic obligation, drink 4 cups of wine. Never says in the Torah, drink 4 cups of wine. Ah, but the first cup of the first night that's a deraisa. It's a mitzvah of kiddush. So that's a deraisa. So for the first cup, you need a 5 fluid ounce cup. And then for the last three, you only need a 3 fluid ounce cup. And on the second night, you need 3 fluid ounce cups the whole time.
To switch out the cup. So right. Is that what we hold?
So, right, Willick doesn't hold like that. So he says, no.
Really?
Because the truth is, see, it's not really that, it's not really the case that there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to drink wine on Friday night. In other words, the mitzvah of kiddush,
right,
is Friday night.
It's the wine. The concept that you said before, right. Saying Kiddushin, and that you just need a taste.
Right. I don't want to say it's only a taste. But I'm saying it's more that it's a rabbinic obligation. In other words, it's a mitzvah. If you want to say that for d'oraisas, let's say eating matzah, right? Where we try eating matzah, so we have a when you eat matzah, so then we take a d'oraisa viewpoint of since eating matzah is a mitzvah d'oraisa, so we take a stricter shear determining how big a kezias is, how big the olive size is, but. When it comes to drinking the wine, even if you hold Kiddush itself as a mitzvah d'oraisa, the wine, according to most Rishonim, is only a mitzvah d'rabbanon, and therefore he would say you could do 3 fluid ounces regardless. With the Mishnah, if the Mishnah Berurah's language actually in the Be'er Halacha, Siman Reish Ayin Aleph, is I think he says that ikaro. See, it's interesting. He doesn't say that he says Kiddush Shalila de Ikaro hu Doraisa. He doesn't say the Kiddush. The root of it is Doraisa.
The recitation
is Doraisa. The recitation, but the wine is only Drabbanan.
But when you still have to make a Bari Kriya Gafen at the end.
So that's a rabbinic obligation. Every bracha. Right, so I'm saying, he holds, I'm saying, Rav, the Mishnah Berurah says the first cup 5, but Willie thinks that, unless I write down when I sent out my sheet, so I say the three fluid ounces for everyone, and then someone will come to me and say, wow, but this year it's Friday nights, and someone will, trust me, a few of you will, and I'll tell them, you're right, that's an opinion, but he's going to say that, no, this is Kiddush Friday night. The wine is only midrabana, then you have to do 3 fluid ounces. What that means, by the way, this is very important. What that means is, if you're with someone who cannot drink a lot of wine, okay, all the person needs to drink is 1.5 fluid ounces of wine, which is very little. Why am I telling you this? Because sometimes what do people do? They drink the most stringent shear, the most strict shear, the most strict amount for the first 3 cups, and by the 4th cup, I don't want it. I'm just going to have a taste. I can have like a little bit. So what I'm telling you is, if you're with someone and you see they're struggling, the most lenient opinion is 1.5 fluid ounces, which is not a lot.
1.5 ounces
per cup. That's the most minimal opinion.
Right. You need to have a little more than that.
Right, 1.51, right. The truth is, you probably don't. Like, it's probably actually a little bit less than 3 fluid ounces, but okay. But
in a 3-ounce cup, or that doesn't matter.
So again, so that goes back to our previous discussion.
No.
But the most minimal position, ideally, you want to do Rove Coast. But I'm telling you, the most minimal position is Rove Revere.
So even if you have an 8-ounce cup,
right.
You could drink 1.5 ounces.
That's the most, go, the most, okay. Most minimal. I'm just telling you.
We go into Seder, my father-in-law is always like measuring liquid into all right. The cups in the house to right. Figure out which ones he can put out on the table.
So what I'm saying is, lechatchila, no, lechatchila, yeah. You want to have Rove Coast. What I'm saying is, if you want to take the stringent view, then you'd have, 5-ounce kosos. If you want to have a little less strict, you want to have the 3 fluid ounce cups. But what I'm saying is that lechatchila, ideally,
any size cup, as long as you're drinking.
No, lechatchila, you want to have Rove Kos.
Right.
I'm telling you. The most minimal position. The most minimal position is a 1.51 fluid, probably even 1.5 fluid ounces.
Well, what's Rove Coast? Is Rove Coast really the majority of the cup, or is Rove Coast more than half?
More than half of the cup.
Yeah. 1.5001.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm telling you is that. What I'm saying is Revius is probably. The shear of Revius is probably actually a little bit less than 3 fluid ounces. It's probably a little bit less. The most makel, mostly. That's another shear, but that's another. It's another class. Okay. 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 So that's it.
Grape juice is okay.
Yeah, I mean, listen. It's better to have a little bit of wine so you could feel. So you could feel something. But if you can't, you could do grape juice. I'm just telling you. That's the. I remember. I'm now. I'm now. I'm now. This is the I tell people I have 48%, I think, alcohol. I do 6%. No, I say 40%. I have to find 5% Bartonura. I don't like it, but I can tolerate it for 4 cups, and then I do the second night. But there was a time in my life where I was struggling. So I had grape juice, and I had a little bit of wine just to feel it. But obviously, you know, if you can't, then it might be preferable to have something so you could feel the... Because, again, to feel the chemus.
The color, but is there...
The
color in terms of red.
It seems that red is better. It seems that red is better. There's.
So you would go out of your way to like add red to the white to make it the color. Like if you're drinking a blue bottle of Bartonura, would you add a little bit of like?
Probably.
Oh yeah.
Unless there are blood libels. No, you think I'm joking? That Mishnah Berurah actually writes that in the place that they say that you should have red to remember where different things, the blood or whatever. But unless the wine is more chashiv, but it seems that you should try to get red. It seems that's more red. But the bishop are right. And in those countries where there are lilos done, where there are blood libels, so you could stay away from the red. So it's okay. That's another shear. But okay. So again, now the we want to talk about reclining.
Yeah, women don't have to recline. This is the best news ever.
Okay. So, bidi'eved, if you, the difference between men and women is that bidi'eved, if a woman doesn't lead, she doesn't have, she doesn't have to lead again, a man has to lead again. The question is, why is there a real difference? Because you have this ravya, right? This ravya is not a halacha of, about men versus women. The ravya basically says that, when did they make the rules about reclining when you're eating and drinking? In Roman times, okay?
They lay
on couches, right? Okay, so
it's not comfortable at all.
Okay, I'm not denying that. So perhaps the question is, what are we doing? Are we going in a time machine and sort of reliving the experience where there was a Beis Hamikdash, maybe even earlier than that, as we'll see in a couple minutes? Okay. So the Ravyas says that when it says you have to act like you're free, you have to act like you're free now. In the Middle Ages, in the medieval times, right? It's not, we don't lean. It doesn't make sense. It's not a sign of freedom. So we don't lean. That was his view. Others disagreed with him. He's not a major league Rishon, but he's quoted. Others disagree with him and say that it's sort of a formal law, which I'm going to try to flesh it out in a couple minutes. It's a kind of formal law when the rabbis instituted it, that this is a sign of leading, and therefore we have to do it whether we feel it's a sign of freedom or not. There is a difference. I don't know if it's a little complicated. This is in the Shulchan Aruch, Taf Ayin, this is source 16, Taf Ayin Beis, Seif Gimel, and Seif Zayin, where the Shulchan Aruch was talking about the difference between the first and second and third and fourth cups. I don't know if you were noticing that. Mm-hmm. So there's something called kemosif al hakosos. There's a concept that if you, let's say, for example, you don't do what you should do when you're drinking the cup, and you drink another cup. So you give you the appearance, oh, there are 5 cups. Right. Oh, there are 6 cups. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do that. Right? So there's a counter pressure of not, if you mess up and you let's say you drank the wine and you didn't do something 100%, so just do it again. No, there's a counter pressure of not doing it again because there's going to be kemosif al hakosos. It's going to create this appearance like you're adding the cups, that there are more cups of wine. So the difference is, it's after the third and fourth, and the truth is, Mishnah Berurah says, you didn't have the source here, after the first cup of wine, after the first, third, and fourth cups of wine, nobody... We don't drink. You know, it's not typical to drink throughout the Seder. He doesn't say anything about the first cup. Mishnah Berurah says the same thing would apply to the first cup. After the first cup, nobody's drinking any more wine until the meal. After the third or fourth cup, nobody's drinking any more wine. After the second cup, what's after the second cup? Shulchan Aruch, the meal. So therefore, if you drink another cup of wine after the second cup, it will not create the appearance like you're adding more cups, because it's like you say, oh, you drink it because it's part of the meal. So therefore, the halacha is that if you fail to drink, if men fail to drink after the first, the third, and the fourth cup, so then they don't drink again because they rely on the ravya. Okay? recline. If they fail to recline while drinking, so then they should not. They can rely on the Rav Yah, and they should. They don't have to drink again. But if they forget to lead when they drink the second cup, so then the men have to drink again, because there's no counter pressure of not drinking again. Shulchan Aruch only mentioned the third and fourth.
At the end, no, it says aval b'shnei kosot rishonot.
Right.
Yachzor v'yishteh.
He says after the first two, because Shulchan Aruch writes that after the first cup is like the second cup, that people would typically drink after the first cup of wine.
For the first two,
I understand. I tell you, it's on the sources that here. Look at the Mishnah Berurah,
we don't follow this.
Right. What I'm saying, the Mishnah Berurah points out that also after the first cup, people don't drink wine nowadays. So the same rule would apply after the first cup. Okay. So the thing about women. So the question. There's a question, perhaps, that prominent women. Did they lead in Roman times? In other words, even the prominent women, did they lead in Roman times? So that may have never been an expression of freedom for women. So that's one question. And so, in other words, if you ask, why is the difference between men and women? So maybe you could say that the men only have the Rav Yah. They have one reason why not to lead. Women have potentially two reasons not to lead. It's because of the Rav Yah. Maybe they didn't lean during Roman times. So that's why women don't have to lean. They don't have to eat the matzah if they forget to recline for that. Rabbi Willick had an interesting way of looking at this distinction, where he said that there are two possible reasons why we do a mitzvah, the mitzvah of leading. One is, this is getting back to the point that we made, well, we don't lead nowadays. There are two possible reasons why you might lead. One is what's called Zecher Ladeis, as a commemoration of the miracle. You're simply acting in a historical manner, even if you don't feel it now. And the second is what's called Pirsum Hanes, where you have to act like you're free. In other words, what is where you're sort of going in a time machine, and what is where you act in a way that nowadays, if people would look at you, they'd say, oh, you're doing something special for the purpose of a miracle. So what he wants to argue is that, the Torah says, there's a medrash on the pasuk which says, Vayasev Elokim Esav, that God, Vayasev, in Parsh Mishalach, that God caused the people, really caused them to circle around, but the medrash says, Malaved, it teaches us that he caused them to do Haseba. So there was some kind of leading. It was so that when we left Egypt, there was some kind of leading, reclining. It's a little difficult because I don't know if there was reclining inside of freedom in biblical times. But there's an idea that one aspect of leading was, this is what we are simply putting ourselves in a time machine and we're doing what was back then. The reason why women are obligated to lead is based on Afhein Hayu Ba'oso Hades. It's based on they were part of the miracle, and their obligation might be what's called Pirsume Nisa. In other words, even though men and women might both be obligated to lead, they might be based on two different reasons. In other words, women are exempt from positive time-bound commandments, mm-hmm. but like for their Chanukah, Mikra Megillah, but due to Afhein Hayu Ba'oso Hades, they're part of the miracle, so therefore they're obligated. But what's the nature of their obligation? That might be different than the man's obligation. So what he suggested was that the man's obligation is based on that the men go in a time machine and they pretend like they're leaving Egypt, and therefore they're acting as if they were when they were leaving Egypt, and that's when they're reclining. Whereas women, their obligation is pirsume nisa, where they have to act as they are now. And so if it's customary now to lean, then they should. If not, not. In practice, women should lean. The custom, I think, women should recline when they eat the matzah, when they drink the wine. But the difference is simply what happens if you fail to lean. So if a man fails to lean when he's eating the matzah, he will have to eat the matzah again. And if a woman fails to lean, she will not have to eat the matzah again.
Is that, like, all opinions say that if a man, like, forgets to lean or...
And so the truth is, it depends on the matzah, it depends, it might be, so all opinions will agree, right, it wasn't a complete answer, but all opinions will, since you asked, all opinions will agree that if a man fails to recline when he is eating the motzi matzah, the mitzvah of matzah, mm-hmm. then he has to eat the matzah again. What if he fails to eat the afikobad? So while eating, there might be a difference as to whether he benched or not. Okay, that's we could talk about that more, but there's more to talk about. But when it comes to eating the mitzvah matzah, so that a man would have to eat again if he failed to lead, a woman would not have to. Okay, so then we move on.
Can I
ask a
question?
Sure.
Because I don't know, I'm having a hard time with this Shulchan Aruch. Maybe it's just the language.
Okay, sure.
A woman does not need to recline unless she is prominent.
Right.
All women are prominent. Yeah. But
I like to say the Rama's wife, you know, told him to put it in there.
That seems to me to be going back to your time travel thing.
Right.
Meaning if you traveled back in time, probably prominent women did lean.
Right.
So Kira brought up the point.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, that like she's just super uncomfortable leaning.
Right.
Like it's just annoying, is what Kira said.
Okay.
She was asking good question about like why.
Okay, listen. The Rama writes, Lo dagu lahakel lahasib ki sabchal divrei Rav Yah. So it seems the Rama is saying that the women did not lead in his days. The Ben Ishchai, who's Sfardi, says that nowadays women do lead, do recline.
But I think there's a deeper question under there, which is like, let's say for you know some men, it's extremely uncomfortable to lean when they're eating, right?
Right.
And like what for whatever reason, right? So like, how is it a sign of freedom if they feel like constricted by this horrible position that they have to be in, like
so what I would say again that women have a reason not to lean, they have grounds not to lean. I just think from an educational standpoint, like if the woman is really suffering, I'll get to the woman. I'll get to the man in a second. What I'm saying is, for a woman, if she's struggling and she's suffering and she's gonna hate, you know, whatever, it's going to make her miserable, she has grounds not to lead. I just think that the whole notion of leading and talking about what freedom means, and even it's like we try to do different things to sort of get people thinking, and you can ask that question. So why if it's a couple, why do we lead? So we're putting ourselves in a time issue. We're trying to relive the experience. So that's an interesting point to even talk about, to think about, and why should we be doing that? I just think that that's an interesting question, and it's an interesting point of departure for a fascinating conversation, which is how do we put ourselves in a situation where we actually feel like in a time of a Beis HaMikdash or when we left Egypt. That being said, a woman, I think, has grounds not to lead if she feels uncomfortable based on, let's say, what Rabbi Willick said, it's based on Persume Nisa. A man seems he doesn't have that to rely on because he may have what's called the Zecher L'Nes. He's obligated to put himself in a time machine. And so that's...
What's the significance of making ourselves feel like it was the time of the Beis HaMikdash anyway? Like we're talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim,
right?
So like why?
So the truth is
like arbitrary.
Yeah. So the truth is okay. So that's a good point. So Rabbi Willig, with his argument is at the time, you put yourself at a time when they left Egypt, where there's a measure. What he said, he made them lean, he made them recline. Now I wonder what that means exactly. I wonder what that means exactly. I think one of my Shabbos Agol addresses. The Medrash says that Melamed something beheseba, like the pasuk says veyaseva kimasam derech hamidbar yamsuf, that God really means He encircled them when they left Egypt. It says Melamed that he made them do heseba, he made them lean. So I wonder if in biblical times, if that was just a cute way of putting that. I think you say, what does Beis HaMikdash have to do with it? So this sort of gets back into my next topic, which is Orchatz. Which is, you know, why we're washing our hands with something that's, you know, if you have a vegetable that's dipped in liquid. So in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, people who were meticulous about Tara, about purity, so they would wash their hands before they would touch something that was dipped in liquid because of the Beis HaMikdash. And when, I believe it was Rabbi Baruch Simon, he spoke at our shul number years back, so he made the point, this is one of his examples, that part of, you know, what we're trying to accomplish, and like what on the night of Pesach, is sort of seeing ourselves leaving Egypt, but being in an ideal state, you know, with a Beis HaMikdash, with the Korban Pesach. So it's an interesting question. What are we supposed to be thinking about? Where are we? Are we stopping, you know, when we left Egypt? Do we continue to Eretz Yisrael?
Well, like washing your hands before you ate something dipped in liquid. That was like a real thing.
That was a real thing, but that was at the time.
Meaning, it's not like a fish fork thing.
That was a real thing.
Okay, no, I'm asking.
That was a real thing dealing with Tuba and Tahara, which is applicable to the time of the Beis HaMikdash. And it could be that we're here, we're sort of yearning, we're not only sort of leaving Egypt, but we want to be in that ideal state of
how they would have in the time of the Beis HaMikdash.
Right. But the question is, what's the reenactment?
Right. I thought,
Mishtana, you're saying, you know, the four things that are different, one of them is to be mesubin, that's different. So how can we say that we shouldn't be doing it because we're uncomfortable?
I mean, it's interesting, though.
So perhaps what we're trying to do is
relive an ideal Seder.
I'm saying Manishtana is,
but it's specifically highlighted.
So Manishtana is already written in the Mishnah time. What I'm saying is that. Maybe what we're doing is we're sort of hinting at, you know, reliving the Yetzias Mitzrayim experience, but reliving it when there's a Beis HaMikdash, maybe.
Wait, sorry, back to the Manishtana. So that was written much later?
Much later than what?
Much later than the Beis HaMikdash.
Not necessarily.
Because then
I'm not saying that.
Are we leaning because we're trying to behave as people behaved then? Or are we leaning because we want to distinguish this night from all the other nights? You can't have it both ways. Either this is the way people behaved, or this is something that makes the Seder distinct from any other night that we're sitting at the table.
And we have plenty of things in the Seder that we learn about that are specifically there to distinguish.
No, I think this would set the Seder apart. So what I'm saying is this, the reclining was a sign of freedom, and everyone does it on the night of Pesach. Everyone does it on the Pesach 2,000 years ago. Everyone does it. So we're all imagining that we're free 2,000 years.
But they didn't do it in general.
Your average poor person did not do it in general.
So leaning was not like a thing that people did.
Certain people did. The aristocracy, royalty did.
Okay.
So they're free
and you're not. Right. You're poor. The Seder
is both. The Seder, I mean, we have things in the Seder that are a remembrance of the leaving of Egypt.
Right.
Matzah is this, Maror is that. And then we have things that are remembrances of celebrating it in the time of the temple.
Right.
Like Korach, whatever.
Okay, right. No, that's my point.
That's my point.
In other words, we're reliving Egypt and reimagining celebrating it maybe in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. So that's the Orchatz. Okay.
I never thought about it that way. I have a question about the hand washing. It might really be a Rachza question.
Okay.
But when we were reading all the sources about the hand washing,
it
seemed that if you were someone who was really concentrated,
you wouldn't have to wash your head in Rachza.
Yeah, you wouldn't ever make a bracha. Wouldn't you ever make a bracha on Tehillat Yadayim? That if you really concentrate and you don't touch anything tameh between Orchatz and Rachza, that you could get away with not ever having to, and then you could eat bread without ever having said Tehillat Yadayim at all?
Correct.
So then we were asking, like, is the bracha not actually, obviously in practice, but technically, is the bracha not a required part?
Right. So what's interesting is that you don't make a bracha from Orchatz because some say we don't do it on something that's the vegetable that's dipped in liquid. So you're saying what if you're washing for the bread, you have in mind that it goes on the vegetable and the bread, would you then make the bracha? Right, right. In other words, let's say you were doing Orchatz and you had in mind like you're going to keep your hands clean between Orchatz and the bread. So then, would you recite a bracha on Orchatz? I don't know. It's a good question.
If you do that, when can you talk again?
I don't mean to burst your bubble.
Complicated with Orchatz, and it's the person leading the ceremony.
There are different customs with that. There are different customs. Some people have only the person who's leading. Some people have everyone. Because again, it's trying to remember a certain event from times past. So that's in our house, everyone does it. But some houses, only the person who's leading it, does it. But it's true. If your hands would be clean, you might not be obligated to wash again.
And you can then have hamotzi without ever having had netilat yadayim.
Well, you would. You had netilat yadayim initially.
You didn't make a bracha.
So there's no requirement to make a bracha so that in order to eat bread, there's a requirement to wash your hands.
Okay.
When you wash your hands for a mitzvah that everyone agrees upon, then you recite a bracha. So for Orchat, not everyone agrees upon this concept.
So then if there's no connection, why do we not speak between the two? What's the connection between the two mitzvot?
Why don't we speak between Netilat Yadayim and eat bread, normally speaking? So I know the Shulchan Aruch said it's good to Tov Li Zahir, it's good to be careful.
But why? If there's no connection between
the two mitzvot, well, there is a connection. You don't want to get distracted. When you get distracted, you might touch things or whatever. Technically, you're right. When you tell, let's put it this way. When you tell, if your child,
right.
let's say they washed their hands and they talked. And right. You said, oh, you talked, you have to wash again. No, you don't. Maybe you should just for a kid. I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure, but maybe for an educational standpoint.
But educationally, you're teaching them. Well.
You're right. I understand. Let's put it this way. If you allow someone to talk, then they might do other things. It can lead. I think that is.
What's the fear? The fear is that your hands will no longer be clean
yes.
And eat the bread.
Yes. What I'm saying is once you know that you're going straight from the washing to the bread, you're not going to do all these other things. I can imagine if you can talk, that you're going to say, okay, let's have. Then you'll start a conversation. You're going to forget about it. I think it does. I think this is a good slippery. I think this is a good practical slippery slope situation.
But definitely the knife and the salt. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. But I try to avoid it. And why should I?
Have the knife and the salt on the table.
I point to things. And as a fence, I try not to talk because once you say one thing, then you may say other things. So it's not that's the language of Shulchan Aruch. It says Tov Lizor. It's good to be careful not to do that because once you're starting conversations, then you can have a really interesting conversation. You forget. Technically speaking,
you have to be very careful.
Yes, you would have to wash again.
Fine.
Correct.
Okay, so I have another question that is not related to the Seder, sorry. Okay. The people that have the custom to wash and then make Kiddush and then say Hamotzi,
right.
That's totally fine.
Yes.
Because as long as they're not involved in
right.
other stuff, it's
right.
fine.
Right.
Can we agree that Yekki is not totally fine?
Can we rehash the thing about Yekki? Not everyone gets up and washes for Yachatz?
For Orchatz.
I meant that?
Yeah.
Not everyone does.
In some places, it's just the head of the household.
Like we all do.
We do it by household too.
We do. Whatever.
Okay.
We read the really old Haggadah that says the head of the house.
But you know what we do? We bring to the head.
And you bring it.
We bring it to
the head. Okay.
Yeah. And the rest of us get up.
Okay.
That's what we do also.
Okay. I've been to some houses where like you just bring it to the men.
Right.
To wash.
Right.
Okay. I don't know. Okay. So the karpas. Okay. So then we discussed about karpas. So the karpas is something which is different. That's clearly to encourage questions. Why are you dipping before the meal? Right. That's in source 21 in Psachim Daf Kuf Yudal Bet Aleph. That's clearly just to ask questions. Why are we having dips when there's no food out? That's very unusual. Now you have this.
So the answer to that question is just about the tears, or is there like more of an answer than that?
So what I used to teach, and I used to go over this, I would always say, I'll give anyone 100 on their tests if they can find me the source for the children's tears. other than the kindergarten Haggadahs. Mm-hmm. The reason that the tears, I mean, I don't want to be like this Mythbuster.
No, that's but, fine. So but the, what is the reason?
No. So the truth is, dipping is a sign of freedom.
Okay.
And the truth is that it was actually a sign of luxury. It was chobet. The truth is, if you read the sources, it seems you could dip it in almost anything. It could be in chobets. It could be vinegar. It could be in other things as well.
It have to be salty.
No, it doesn't have to be
something sweet.
Okay, the middogis, it didn't be dealt in salt. Is it sweet? It's something that's a typical dip. I know that's the middog. Can it be in anything? Maybe. I think like they say the charoses, that's specific for the maror. I haven't seen people do other things, but they mentioned vinegar or something else. Whatever is a typical dip. It's just a question. Can you get one of those dips? You know that are
yeah.
No, but in other words, I have to see what I mean, you know.
You're saying there is no source that says that we use something vinegary or salt watery
because for the tears. No, for the tears, I don't.
Random.
I have. This way, I haven't found the source. I haven't found. If you could find it, that'd be great. Okay, I haven't found the source. I haven't found. No, what we do have. See, the karpas itself. That vegetable is a sign of slavery,
right?
Because that's with the letters, right? Sabech Perach, right? Karpas, the letters Sabech, then Perach, 600,000 people had Perach, had bitter work. That's the reason why the vegetable they use was called Karpas. So the Parach, right? Parach, right. So what I'm saying is the vegetable is a sign of slavery, but the dipping, that's a sign of freedom. I haven't found. Maybe there is a source. I haven't found. And if you just find it in Haggadah, you say, oh, the Haggadah says this. I want to know where the Haggadah got the source from. So if you find it, I'd love to see
so
its source.
What is karpas then?
It's a vegetable. It's
which
dipping.
Which one?
They're different ones. Different ones.
There's that whole specific thing, but
karpas may actually be a specific vegetable. I'm not sure what that is. But the truth is really any vegetable. You have any? I mean, I would say any vegetable. It's some people have celery or parsley or potato, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But the point of it is that you're dipping. You're dipping to create. This is a sign of freedom. And what did you say you have in mind? You're going to be dipping later. Oh my gosh, two dipping. That's pretty fancy. Right, it's pretty fancy. I mean, nowadays, you go to wherever Super Salt, you get like 10 different dips, so it's not so fancy. But back then, to have two dips, that's what you said. Have in mind the bracha. We're going to be dipping later, so that's something that's very fancy. You know what I'm saying, the dipping, that's the freedom. That's the sign of freedom. The vegetable karpas, so that's the sign of parents. That's the sign of slavery.
And if you dip the parsley in salt water, it's
bodek.
You found the
Okay. Karpas, I'm sorry. Karpas is kaf, resh, pei, sabach. So take out the sabach, right? So that's 60 times 10,000, 600,000 people had perach, which is parach, which is, okay, I'm just telling you, okay? Okay? But by the way, just remember, that a lot of this, what's the purpose of this? Ki hecha de lehevi heker letidokos. So even if you're not excited about it, kids love gematrios.
Yeah.
Okay, so remember, even if you don't, okay, I understand, but what I'm saying, my point is, I'm saying that's not the whole thing of the Seder, all these gematrias, let's have a conversation, but what I'm saying is, this is for this to get the kids excited, so I'm saying I'm not so bothered by the fact that they use a gematria.
That my father enacts is not an option.
Okay,
how come we don't do other fancy stuff that's actually fancy now?
Because it's tradition. Tradition is very powerful. Tradition is very powerful. Okay, we don't underestimate tradition. Okay, I'm saying.
I'm saying
in a positive sense because you're doing something that was done 100, 200, it's something that's very, especially for the kids. I'm saying it's something that's very powerful. I'm doing what was done. Like it really connects you back with the Mesorah. It's a very powerful thing.
Requirement is that you should act as if you were there
right.
in those times.
Right.
So the people who come with the gunny sacks right. on their back.
Right, that's hard. Out, right, that we have that here.
To make you feel that way. Right. If you feel that way without it, fine.
Right.
If you need encouragement.
Right. Okay. So anyway. Okay. I gave a drasha 9 years ago about that, but not for now. Okay, now, I gave a joke about that. That's why I said, why is it so late? I said initially, I mean, I'll tell you. Initially, the Seder, initially the times of the Beis HaMikdash, the Seder was, you went with your parents, you went with your dad to slaughter the meat, and you ate meat, and then you sang. That was the whole thing. The experience, the experience was shechting the Korban Pesach, eating meat, and then you sang Hallel.
Eating meat at midnight?
Like, not midnight. You ate the meat and then you sang the Hallel. Then you sang the Hallel. But basically, once there was no experience of Korban Pesach, so they had to transform it into this educational experience. So that it changed. But okay, let me move on. Karpas. Okay, so what I tell you is there's a debate about whether you have to have a kazayas of karpas. And the reason why there's a debate is another major discussion. But there's a question, so I think in some of the sources you saw, there's a question whether you need an achila. An achila, did you acquire a kazayas? If it's simply so the kid should ask questions, you don't need a real achila, you just need a taste. So there are some opinions, and the Shulchan Aruch writes that better not to have a kazayas. Why is it better not to have a kazayas? Because there's a major debate as to whether, it's been a debate between Rashi and the Ri, I don't think in the sources here, but there's a major debate as to whether if you eat a kazayas, whether you have to recite a bracha achrona. Why? Because the question is the magid an interruption? In other words, if you have the karpas now, you eat the karpas now, so you're going to have the mora later. Right. So maybe you can't make the bracha achrona because you're going to have, right, you make the bracha now, but you're still sitting at the table, and you have the mora later. You can't make the bracha achrona. Or maybe you'll say, no, the magid, you have a whole long conversation, the magid is an interruption, so you should make the bracha achrona. So this is a major debate. It also is related to the question of, why don't you make a bracha bar pi adam on the maror? Why don't you make a bracha bar pi adam on the maror? What's the answer to that? So some people, what do they do before you have the karpas? Remember to have in mind for the maror. Mm-hmm. So there's another reason why perhaps you may not have to say bar pi adam on the maror. What's the other reason why you don't say bar pi adam on the maror?
You don't have enough.
Right? No.
That's yummy.
So maybe, okay. But
this is so bitter, you don't...
Well, the lettuce is not so bitter to me, by the way. The other reason is, let me ask you a question. How many of you recite a bracha, bar pi adam, in the middle, when you have a salad, in the middle of a bread meal? We don't.
No.
So in other words, is the reason why you don't recite the bar pi adam in the mara, is it because it's like salad in the middle of a bread meal?
But you haven't had.
No, you have the matzah. You have matzah, then you have the maror. No, I'm saying for the maror. What I'm saying is this question. What I'm saying is there's a major question whether the magid is an interruption. If the magid is an interruption, so therefore, you should require new bracha bar pi adam on the maror. But according to that opinion, it's the middle of the meal. Then you don't recite a bracha. But when you having in mind for the karpas on the maror, so what are you saying? The magid's not an interruption. So make the bar pi adam on the karpas. It also is going on the maror. Because this is a major debate, you have less than a kazayas of karpas. So you still have to starve a little bit later. Okay? Now, let's move on. Now, okay, well, that's right. Okay. So matzah, right? So matzah is it's lechem oni. So remember we saw there are two different reasons for the lechem oni, right? One is it's lechem she'oni, this is source 26 in Gemara Psachim, kuf tesvav beis, lechem she'oni v'alav devar harbe. So it's a bread that we speak a lot of things about it. So that is so, right? We talk a lot about the matzah. Or it's lechem oni, which is a poor person doesn't have a full piece of bread, it has a broken piece of bread. Right? So then, what else do I want to... So then we have this issue of the magid. And the magid, so we're talking about the difference between zechira and sipur. Right? So first of all, the Rambam holds, there's a major question, that when the Rambam has his list of mitzvos, he doesn't include the daily obligation of Yetzias Mitzrayim as one of the mitzvos. Right? In other words, what we say in the Shema every day, Ani Hashem Elkeich Mishar Tzeitzi Yitzchem Eretz Mitzrayim, I'm Hashem Yigar who took you out of Egypt. So every day we fill the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. We mention Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Rambam in his list of mitzvos does not include this in his list of mitzvos. Why not? So one answer, I'm only going to tell you one answer. One answer is that we hold like Benzoma. You got it, right? No. So what does Benzoma say? In source 30, the Gemara Bracha, Shud Beis of Beis, says, Ben Zoma said, according to Ben Zoma, are we going to recite? Ben Zoma says we recite Yitzias Mitzrayim at night. So we say, Adi Hashem Elokechem, write that line in the day and at night. And according to the Chachamim, this Yimei Chayecha versus Kol Yimei Chayecha, the extra word, tells you not only do you have to say it now, but also even in the Messianic era we have to say it. Meaning what? According to Ben Zoma, he's going to say, we will not say it in the Messianic era. In other words, he's saying, Kol teaches you even at night. Mm-hmm. Meaning he disagrees with the Chachamim. Meaning Ben Zoma holds that in the Messianic era, we will not be reciting Yisif Mitzrayim every day. Why not?
Because we'll have been redeemed again in a bigger way.
In a bigger way, right. Now, in other words, the miracles of the final redemption will be so unbelievable that it won't be necessary to mention it every day. So that's one answer. That's why the Rabbam doesn't mention it, because the Rabbam only mentions those mitzvos that will apply even in Messianic era. So I'm just telling you. So that's Ben Zoma. By the way, I'm taping this, so you could review this. I'll give you a lot of information. You should listen to it again. You should review it. You'll remember a lot of different points here. Okay, the difference between Sipur and Zechira, right? There's a bunch, so what's the difference, right? The Minchas Chinuch we saw means that Sipur means you're telling the miracles in depth. You're telling the children. He suggested that. And Rav Chaim Brisker has the famous three differences, where he says that you are... It's verse 32, Psachim Kuf Tes Zayin and Aleph, the Chidushi Agrach, where he says that Sipur involves Q&A,
right.
Question answer. It involves starting with the bad, ending with the good, and you give reasons. The way I look at it as the daily Zechira, the daily is thank you, God. Every day it's good to thank God. You know, thank you, God, I appreciate you. Thank you for taking me out of Egypt. Sipur is an in-depth focus on one night, how critical it is to our very existence. Mm-hmm. Sort of like, you know, hopefully every day, you know, say, for someone's spouse to say to each other, I love you. And once a year, you celebrate the wedding anniversary, right? To really focus on it, right? So between Zechira and Sipur. Okay? So we move on to Rachza. Right, so that's the idea. That it's better to go to the bathroom if you're a clean freak, between Orchatz and Rachza, you know, just make sure you go to the bathroom or something or touch whatever. So the dirty areas. So So okay, just touch your shoes. I don't know, to scratch your head, your hair, whatever. So because it's a question, right? So I have a question whether you can make the. They ask this question because if you're really kept clean, then there might be a question. Can you make a bracha on this?
I actually had a question about this because it said something about how that touching holy scripture renders your hands impure. What does that? Is that?
Right. So that was, I think, if I recall correctly, I believe that they made this gzera that they wanted people, I think, to wash their hands because they didn't treat it disrespect. They didn't want it had to do with not treating the Kisvei Kodesh disrespectfully. So somehow they said it made your hands tame, so somehow you would purify your hands before. And I think I may not be 100% correct, but this was like it's something that had to do with the file concern about, I believe, about disrespecting Kitzvei Kodesh. But let me look into that. Okay, so now let's go to Motzi Matzah. So again, there are two different Torah obligations of Matzah, okay? So the difference between matzah and mara, right? Matzah nowadays is a Torah obligation. Mara is a rabbinic obligation. You all got that, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Torah says, al matzah sebrom yochluhu. So when there's a mitzvah of Korban Pesach, there's also a mitzvah of matzah and mara to eat it together with the Korban Pesach. So nowadays we don't have a Korban Pesach, so therefore there's no other Torah obligation for mara. So therefore the obligation for mara is only rabbinic. And that's why... Incidentally, that's why when I give you my list of shiurim for how large a maror has to be, so I have a smaller shiur for kezayis when it comes to maror, because maror is only a rabbinic obligation, as opposed to matzah, which is a biblical obligation, because the pasuk says, ba'erev tochlu matzos. That's why korech, I have a smaller shiur for the size of matzah for korech, because that is only a rabbinic obligation. Okay? So then you have this debate between Rashi and the Rambam, whether the prusa, you know, are you supposed to have three matzahs or two matzahs, right? In other words, motzi matzah, right? When you have, you know, you have lechemish, you have two loaves of bread, right? So you can't have bread on Pesach, so you have two matzahs. So now, when you're adding that piece of, you have to have a prusa, you have to have a broken piece of matzah. Is that in addition to the two matzos? Or is it modifying? I actually gave this drush, this is my Shabbos Kodesh, I think the second year, third year. It was too halachic, I think. I do a little more, less halachic. The question was, is this obligation of lechem odi with prusa, is it adding to the lechem mishnah, or is it modifying it? So that's why you have two and a half, right? Are you really having, you're making a motzi on two and a half, or are you making it on one and a half? Right, that's the debate. We hold generally two and a half. And then you have this debate about whether you have to have two kazaisib or one kazayas. Right? You have the debate. By the way, okay, just this notion, if you have to have two kazaisib, right? So that is only a rabbinic obligation. Right? Because you have to have what? Because it's not clear whether the mitzvah of matzah is on the whole matzah or the broken matzah. So since we're not sure, there's an obligation to eat matzah, and there's also obligation when you write hamotzi, right? When you're doing two things, you're making bracha hamotzi, you're taking a piece of bread, which happens to be matzah, so then you can have a small amount.
Right.
And then, but the mitzvah, achilas matzah, so that is, you have to have a whole kazayas. So there's a question as to, if you got the sources, as to, it's in the Rush, as to which one is the mitzvah of matzah? Is it the whole one or the broken one? So therefore, you have to have both. Now, the truth is, I would imagine in many of your households, only one person has all three matzos.
Right, there's not enough.
Right. It's okay. So as I'm saying, this is like a chumrah. I'm saying, so some people may want to have every person have three matzos themselves, but if they don't, then you really don't have to have the two, there's no point in having the two kazesim. If you're having the three matzahs and you want to be machmir, you want to be strict, so that you're going to have, you'll have one kazayas for the top and one kazayas for the middle. But since that is only a rabbinic obligation, so therefore the shear of kazayas, that you have to have a kazayas of matzah, that has to be the biblical shear, which is, let's say, 4/10 of a matzah. But the shear about one, what, you know, one kazayas from the top and one from the middle, that only has to be rabbinic. Mm. There's the total amount has to be a kazayas doraisa, which is I think I have here it's like 4/10 of a hand matzah.
If you have like two rabbinic kazayasim will equal one.
Well, no, it's actually less. The most minimal shear, a rabbinic kazayas, according to my calculations, is 1/6. I said that something which is what says what they are, but it's 1/6 of a hand matzah. So the truth is, a biblical one is more than double.
Oh, so you still need more.
Right. So when I tell people, if you notice when I send the hand off, how much matzah you're going to have, I'm going to say you have to, according to fulfill this opinion, you should have 2/5 of a hand matzah, right? But at least 1/6 of the top, 1/6 of the middle, and the total should be 40% of a hand matzah. But what I'm telling you is that the kazayas of matzah is the deraisa, but those who are strict and have their own three matzos and have a kazayas of each, that's only rabbinic. That will explain that handout.
But again, okay. The measurements with the rulers and stuff, that's what we're supposed to...
Well, you can follow my handout, which is less strict than the rulers. I send it out every year.
There's no issue on Shabbos with the measuring.
Might not, because you can measure for a mitzvah.
Uh-huh, okay.
So the person who has all the matzahs, not right. That everybody has right. The matzah, they have to have a stack of matzahs.
Right. So what I would say is like this. Let's say there's one person who has the three matzos. So in other words, if you're reciting, if I'm reciting hamotzi, and you're being yotzi with my hamotzi, I have to give you a bit of that hamotzi. Mm-hmm. Right, so what I do is, not everyone in my household has three matzos. You know, I have it. I think Natal now wants because he's learning all these sugyos, so he wants his three matzos. So I give everyone who wants, but okay, then some other people have. So, but what I make sure is I give everyone a piece of the top, a piece of the middle,
right.
But I make sure that I at least have 1/6 of the top and 1/6 of the middle for me, and I make sure I have at least 4/10 of a matzah. So in other words, I make it's not that complicated.
So
I make
six.
No, it's not complicated. No, it's not complicated.
You
no,
have a sixth
I, and a sixth. No. In other words, I make sure when I'm divvying it out, I make sure that just like when you divvy out on Shabbos, make sure everyone gets a piece of bread. So I make sure everyone gets a piece of matzah
you
from
the
top.
two.
So, okay, it's still too much for me. But you. That's why I'm sitting down. What I do. So I make, instead of giving out one piece of challah, I give out one piece of the top matzah and one piece of the middle matzah, a small piece of top and a small piece of the middle to every single person. And then I make sure there's enough of 1/6 for the top, 1/6 for the middle for me.
And then you need a little bit extra.
A little bit extra.
To get up to the 4/10.
Eat that shiur is what you're saying.
You're saying this to the two kazaisim? That depends. This, it's a little bit of a chumrah, this position, that you have to have a sixth from each. It's a little bit of a chumrah. If someone in my household would want to do it, I would be fine with them doing it. I don't have a problem with it.
That's what I'm saying. So where you're keeping all of your matzot,
right,
you should have many.
I'll have three by me. And then I'll have, let's say, a stack, and other people want to keep three, and I'll be, so I'll make sure that everyone first gets the piece, the two small pieces for me, and then they can take whatever they want to have, like a half a matzah, whatever.
Right.
Okay. So, right. Now, the last thing we'll talk about is the matzah shmura. The idea of matzah shmura is there are two aspects of Shmura, right? What are the two aspects of Shmura? So what aspect of Shmura is, what are your Shomer, what are you being Shomer from? Okay, so you're trying to avoid it becoming Chametz. That's one definition. There's another definition of Shibur. I think we had it here. So that was source 52, the Rab Hilchot Chametz Matzah, Perkei Alach Haches, when they say Shmartim Es Matzah, Kolobar Hizaru B'Matzah V'Shibru Osa Mikol Tzad Chibur. So you should guard it so it doesn't become Chametz. Mm-hmm. What's the other definition of Shibur? That's the next one, the Rashi, where he says you should be Shibur L'Shei Mitzvah. You should guard it for the purpose of using it for the Mitzvah Matzah. In other words, when you're making the matzah, you should say, this is the shame matzah mitzvah. You should, so there are two different aspects. One is that you're doing it for the purpose of the mitzvah. You're making it for the purpose of the mitzvah. And another one is you're just practically making sure that it doesn't get wet. No water falls on it to avoid any potential fermentation, any potential leavening. Again, it seems on the surface from the sources that we've seen that this is only, in the Shulchan Aruch writes this in Tafnun Gimel Sa'if Dalet, source 55, this only applies to the matzah of the mitzvah. In other words, only the matzah of the first two nights and only that one kazayas. Everything else, it doesn't seem you need to have it. However, there are other, some are strict to have it, a matzah shmura, all week. So for two possible reasons. So number one is there's an opinion of the Vilna Gaon. It's fascinating that the Torah says eat matzah, don't eat chametz. Eat matzah, don't eat chametz. And it says, I believe it says, so the Vilna Gaon understands that during the first two nights there's what's called a chiyuv, an obligation, and during the rest of Pesach, there is you fulfill a mitzvah if you eat matzah, a mitzvah kiyumis. There's no obligation. I believe, I hope I'm quoting this correctly, I believe that, you know, my Rabbi Rav Roenzweig once said that if you look at different prohibitions in Judaism, halakha prohibitions, there's what's called an iser kavra, which means a prohibition on the person. You can't act a certain way. You're not allowed to murder. You're not allowed to commit adultery. These are prohibited actions. Then there's what's called an iser cheftza. This object is forbidden to you. Non-kosher food is forbidden to you. When he calls chametz, he called a cheftza shel iser. Not just fun terminology, but it's something that's forbidden that you have to do something to it. You have to destroy it. You have to disassociate yourself from it. You can't simply stay away from it. You actually have to burn it. You have to destroy it. So it doesn't fit into any of these categories. And I think he wanted to argue that maybe the Vilna Gaon was sort of taking that position, is that during Pesach, when you eat matzah, the fact that the Torah says It says, eat matzah 7 days, don't eat chametz. Eat matzah doesn't just say don't eat chametz. It doesn't say just eat matzah. It says for 7 days, eat matzah, don't eat chametz. Eat matzah, don't eat chametz. This is a lot of times. The juxtaposition highlights that when you are eating matzah, that's a rejection of chametz. Whatever the chametz means, the Yitzhar, whatever the symbolism means, the philosophical symbolism that it means, but it's a rejection of the chametz. So Vilna Gaon holds that every time that you are eating matzah on Pesach, Kazayas, it's not a chiyuv, but you're fulfilling a mitzvah. So then, maybe then you want to have what you want to have, maybe matzah shmura, because that might be matzah's mitzvah. Another reason might be is that, you know, the custom is to, the Rambam seems to say, the custom seems to be all week. The custom is that he should have all matzo, see the Berlachan, Simon Tav Samech Seif Aleph, the Berlachan, so it seems to say for all, you know, that all the matzah you eat, you should guard it. Even though Shulchan Aruch only mentions just the matzah of mitzvah, but you should guard it, you know, all the time. There are different points in time where you guard it from. So, by the way, guarding could be Bishas Ketzira. We call matzah shmuras Bishas Ketzira. The truth is, most matzah that we buy, I believe, is guarded also Bishas Techida for the time of grinding. So the truth is, even non matzah shmura is still shmura from a later stage. The idea of, so then the final thing is the idea of machine matzah. I spoke about that during Shal Shudas, and I'm speaking on it again this Shal Shudas. It's interesting. So it's the major halacha question about machine matzah is this idea of, we said, what's matzah shmura? It has to be guarding from any potential leavening. So then the early machines, if they weren't so well, they weren't done so well, so maybe we got some chametz stuck here and there that was unprocessed. Now that's not an issue with the machines. The other issue is that it has to be lishma, you have to have intent. So the question is, when you press a button, is that you doing it, or is it the machine doing it? So that was the question also. What was the most fascinating, which is beyond the scope of the shir, which is the most fascinating, is that, you know, this was a time of innovation. And this is like in the, I believe, the 1840s or 1850s, when they first came up with the idea of a machine. So they're saying that, I quoted this, Shlomo Kluger had this tshuva. And he first brought the halachic reasons, and then he said, well, he made the halachic reason that, you know, it's not lishma, and there's a concern of chavetz, but then he said, you know, there's something called moschitim, okay? Poor people, you know, they need money for Pesach. And you know the poor people get a lot of their money for Pesach? They're the ones who bake the matzah. And you're taking away their parnasa if you build these machines. And he said, historically, the meaning of Klal Yisrael is that the matzos are circle, and that's a minhag, and how dare you have it squared. I'm saying, this was an innovation, like, you know, the Chassam Sofer, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, the innovations are forbidden. And so there was some of that going on there in terms of the whole machine matzah episode.
Why didn't he say that poor people can afford to buy them?
Well, that's a little different than nowadays. But I say back then, okay, it was a little early on. But I'm saying, so that's a fascinating discussion when it comes to machine shmur matzah. Some would argue that maybe machine shmur matzah is actually cleaner, the machines are cleaner than your average person who's baking matzah. But that's a little bit of the debate of machine matzah. So we said a lot. Hopefully there's some new stuff here. Yeah. I'm going to put this online. You should review this, and you can learn a lot of stuff at the Seder. So you'll hopefully, we don't have time for the next half. Next year we'll do the next half.
Next
year. We don't have time before next year before Pesach. We'll do from
Moron. Regarding eating matzah before Rosh Chodesh versus 30 days before, which is minhag. I get confused if
that's
what it does. And it doesn't matter, like.